Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we are committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportsscience.com. I'm your host, Andrew Rizza, an allied healthcare professional with over 25 years of experience. My career has primarily spanned private physical therapy and public school athletics. Driven by curiosity and a passion for the industry, I created the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast to explore the ever-evolving landscape of healthcare with a focus on sports medicine, physical therapy, athletic training, and sports science. Each week, we'll dive into the challenges healthcare professionals encounter and discuss how collaboration can enhance understanding within the industry. Our goal is to improve the experience for patients and athletes alike. Now, on to the show. On this week's Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, I'd like to welcome Victor Chang. Victor is the co-founder of Cypress Tree, a private equity firm focusing on investing in the rapidly growing cannabis industry. Currently, their portfolio includes the ready adult use dispensaries in Newton and Natick, Massachusetts. Prior to Cypress Tree, Victor co-founded Balter Capital Management in 2005, a boutique hedge fund that reached peak assets of $1.4 billion. At BCM, he served as the COO and chief compliance officer. Outside of work, Victor lives in Wellesley with his wife and two kids and enjoys spending his free time on the golf course. Now on to the show. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's Behind the Sports Medicine podcast. This week, I have Victor Chang, CEO and co-founder of Ready, which is a Boston-based cannabis company. Victor and I met about a year ago, about probably shy of a year, about 11 months ago. He was referred over to me from Dr. Gill for a shoulder injury that I had the pleasure of working with Victor. And lo and behold, you know, what a small world it is. We started talking about, you know, previous things that he'd done in his life, athletics. And he said he was a swimmer. And I said, oh, where'd you swim? And Victor goes, Weston. And I said, oh, really? Weston, huh? And we got that connection with me being the athletic trainer over at Weston High School. And my, you know, one of my mentors and the person hired me, Pete Foley, everybody knows him as Foles, was Victor's swim coach. So pretty small world. So Victor, thank you for coming on. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Excited. And thanks to Coach Foley.
Yeah, Foles is the man. We're keeping him together too with some duct tape these days, but he's doing all right.
That's good. He's been such a positive influence on so many people. I don't even think he appreciates how much he's really done for kids. So
it's amazing. You know, his legacy, and then you know, Coach Valley after him, and you know, having those two people in your lives, it's pretty amazing. You know, they're like a rock star coaching staff. So
yeah, definitely.
Can you tell the listeners a little bit about your background and how you actually got into the cannabis industry?
Sure. So local kid, right? Grew up in Weston. I live in Wellesley. I think my wife jokes we're 4 miles from the house I grew up in. And really, this started back probably in 2015. At the time, I was at a small boutique hedge fund in Boston. We had a family office client come to us and say, hey, we legalized medical marijuana in Massachusetts. This could be really interesting. Why don't you guys go figure out something about this? He did a number of reach outs to the licensees, ended up spending some time with a couple of them. We didn't ultimately make an investment, but it was clear this was a super interesting industry, you know, new and emerging and obviously fraught with regulatory hurdles because it was still federally illegal. But it was something where you could see from an investment perspective, hey, there's a lot of potential upside here. Sort of fast forward a couple of years, I was looking for sort of new opportunities, and a childhood friend of mine from Weston reached out. He comes from the real estate world. So his name's Todd Fennard, another Weston grad. And from his perspective, right, the real estate world has been turned upside down, and commercial real estate, particularly by Amazon, right? So his family helped build the original Natick Mall. They've done a bunch of hotels, but the retail industry is, you know, just not the same post Amazon. And he's always been curious on if cannabis could be sort of an anchor tenant, whether that was for retail, whether that was for a hotel, could that be the draw to bring customers in? And so we started talking about the opportunity. We'd been, you know, sort of investigating it. And when question four passed in November of 2016, which legalized adult use here in Massachusetts, it was something where he and I said, yeah, we got to do something here. So in the beginning of 2017, we started looking, and what we had quickly figured out was, unlike every other state in the country that has done legalized adult use, the state regulator is not really the gatekeeper, right? Most states, getting the state license is the critical component. In Massachusetts, it really is the local municipality. So it's that city or town, and are they going to let you operate a cannabis operations, whether it's a dispensary or cultivation in their community, is kind of the real gatekeeper. The state itself is, you know, obviously going to then certify you, but they're not really there to prevent the business. So Todd basically said, listen, this is what I do, special permitting. I will get us better retail locations. We'll find some operating partners and we'll sort of merge with them, joint, you know, sell our assets to them, you know, maybe acquire them, take a board seat. This will be fun. It'll be a sort of a side adventure. And that was always the intention. Mm-hmm. And our challenge really was that we never really found that operating partner. I think a lot of the licensees here in Massachusetts are very interesting people. They're very passionate about the plant, but it's a very challenging industry, particularly given the federal status of it. And it was hard to envision, you know, a lot of these folks giving them and helping them raise millions of dollars to get operational and, you know, sort of hoping for the best. So it sort of snowballed into becoming a full-time opportunity for myself. And I think, you know, we've done a really good job of placemaking retail. So we've got a doors open operations in Newton and one in Natick. We're working on a third location. And, you know, we are just retailers. We never actually got into the cultivation end of the business. So, you know, we just run our retail and try to service our customers as best as possible and educate them as much as we can. Because cannabis is very new, and it's there's a lot of people coming with lots of questions. So we really try to focus in on the educational end. I think we're one of the very few retail or adult use dispensaries that offer consultations. Mm-hmm. It's a requirement under the medical program, but not under adult use. So that's something that we really stand out on.
Yeah, it's an interesting story, I think, because when you and I first met, we were talking and I just said, oh, what do you do? And then this, you know, this conversation started and I was very intrigued because, you know, we wonder how it actually affects people in the medical industry or people that we deal with, because we get the conversation, you know, quite frequently when patients are having difficulty with pain. And that's when you and I started chatting and I said, you know, I'd like to learn a little more about this. So maybe we can kind of sit down and talk about it. But I actually know, I would say Mr. Fernard, but I had his son, he's a good lacrosse player that went through Weston. So, you know, it's nice how you have, you know, childhood friends that kind of remember. And I think you joked with me, your wife was making fun of you because you have more high school friends or stay close to them than she would say that she would probably do growing up as a kid. You know, it's kind of interesting how tight knit Weston is.
It really is. I would tell you, I'm close with a lot of my high school friends, and I think that is a little unusual, but I like it. You know, these are people you've shared a lifetime with, literally a lifetime with.
Yeah, and it's great. You know, like you said, trying to, you know, keep that relationship going, and it definitely has paid off. You know, obviously professionally, right? So, what's the difference now, me being a person that doesn't know much about this, other than when you were growing up, you know, people go, I'm going to buy some, you know, weed, you know, it's like, what's the difference? So I think the big thing is, what's the difference between somebody buying a product off of the street versus in a commercial regulated location? Can you explain that a little bit to people that maybe like myself that don't have any idea about it?
Right. Yeah. So, you know, if you're buying off the street, you've got a local dealer. I mean, the reality is you just don't know where it's coming from. Mm-hmm. There are, you know, obviously there are no testing requirements. You know, there's always the real fear that it's laced with something else. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's the biggest risk, right? Particularly if it's a real drug dealer, you know, candidly, they want to get you hooked on something more potent than cannabis. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that's the big thing. Within a store, you know, this Massachusetts, I would tell you, is probably the most strict in terms of our regulatory requirements for cannabis in the country. Mm-hmm. So in terms of, you know, pesticides, heavy metals, microbials, you know, we have the strictest limits in the country. You know, I always like to joke that the water in Wellesley would fail cannabis testing for heavy metals. Milk would fail for, you know, bacteria. So, you know, what you're getting in a store has been through a state licensed testing agency. It's going to be safer, you know, in Canada, you just know what you're getting. And I think a few years ago, there was that real fear, right? There was that vape crisis that happened where a lot of kids were getting sick on vaporizers. Those were really, you know, illicit market products, because what dealers were doing was cutting the oil that you put in a vaporizer with vitamin E acetate. And the only reason they picked that was the vitamin E acetate looks very similar in terms of the color, the viscosity of the oil as cannabis oil. And so this is sort of no different than, you know, taking a bottle of vodka and sort of diluting it with water, right? They were just trying to dilute the product so that they could make more money. The problem with vitamin E acetate is it's a large molecule, so your lungs won't absorb it. And so that's why you're getting these sort of lung and respiratory issue. You're literally just caking the inside of your lungs with this, right? This is something that obviously at the state level we're testing for, and a product would never pass. So therefore couldn't be sold. So I think that's probably the biggest thing, is really, you know what you're buying when you come into a state licensed dispensary.
Now, is that, going back to the vaporizer, is that what people were calling like popcorn lung? Like when they end up getting more of that respiratory disease, or start of a respiratory disease?
Yep. That's exactly what it is.
Okay. Because I know there was a big fear. I think our daughter is, you know, in her almost mid-20s now. But when she was in middle school, I think, you know, this is almost 10 years ago, right? So I think it was probably right around that time where there's a lot of these kids were having these problems and, you know, using vapes. And I think there was a big, you know, uproar about it. I just, you know, not knowing enough about it. My wife's a nurse. She knows more than I do. And she talks about it a lot because she's in the, you know, public school system. So she knows. And they talk about this quite frequently on a lot of the stuff. You had mentioned, you know, the regulations in the state. The amount of testing that you go through now and how you guys regulate product, did you see an uptick in the amount of, you know, retail sales or revenue sales when we started seeing a lot of these people that were overdosing on fentanyl? Because we know fentanyl can be in anything. Did you see more people coming to, you know, your locations, or see an uptick in the state? Or is that something that was kind of hard to be able to measure, given that it was, you know, more through other hardcore drug use?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to measure. You know, and I would tell you right now, sales continue to grow in the state, in terms of both number of people coming in, the frequency that they're coming in. But I think we're still very early on in terms of adoption, right? I think there's just still too many people who they're kind of curious. They want to know. They may or may not want to try something. But I think we're still really early days in terms of, you know, having something like an illicit product, you know, trying to drive too much to, you know, new consumers into the cannabis world. I think it was more, you're a cannabis consumer, you've discovered, hey, you know, these adult use ones, you know, products has gotten way better in terms of quality on the flower end. It's really, it really improved since early days, where I think, you know, that connoisseur class who probably had their dealer was a little fearful of, you know, what else they may be getting, but may not have gone to dispensary early days because they were like, man, the quality of the flower in dispensaries is just so low. Like, screw it, I'm going to stick with my dealer. You know, that's, that pendulum is swung where, you know, the cultivators here in Massachusetts have been able to find, you know, dial it in, and quality is really there. And I would argue that, you know, our premium flower grown and sold in the legal channel is as good as anything you'll get on the illicit channel.
Now, you mentioned that you guys aren't in the cultivating business. Have you ever, since you've been in business for the many, many years that you have been, have you thought of getting into that and helping your business grow, or get into the other side of it? Or is it something that is just, you know, not even in kind of the wheelhouse?
No, we definitely thought about it. You know, we went through the licensing of two different sites. You know, I've definitely worked out relationships with cultivators that I, you know, would have brought on. You know, it's a, it's a very expensive end of the industry, right? By far the most CapEx needed to build out a cultivation site, it, you know, is where you're going to spend most of the money you're going to, if you're invested in this industry. And then it's a really difficult business to run. It is a living plant. Harvest to harvest, things can change dramatically. The state has such strict requirements, you know, particularly on like pesticide use, that it's a really hard business to grow, particularly here in Massachusetts, right? Ultimately, you know, not to oversimplify it, but a cultivator's biggest challenge with cannabis is humidity.
Okay.
The flower itself is super dense. So it's very easy for powdery mildew or mold to develop inside the flower. So you need a lot of airflow. You need to really control the humidity. And in Massachusetts, our summers are super humid, right? So you're really battling the ambient environment versus if you were to go to a Colorado, California, you know, Washington State, Oregon, Oklahoma, they just don't have the same sort of humidity issues that we do. Because it's a dry heat. So you have to spend a lot of money to get into cultivation. You have to have a really good cultivator to run that business. It's, you know, fraught with a lot of challenges. And really now at this point, the issue has become, there's just so much canopy in the state. You know, we are definitely in an oversupplied state. So, you know, for a cultivator, it's challenging to make money. You know, and after spending tens of millions of dollars to build out your infrastructure, it's a little hard to just walk away from that business, right?
Yeah,
so,
right.
I mean, I think it would have helped us in the short term. In the long run, it probably would have been more painful. And if there was ever federal reform, you know, it'd be a line of the business that you would definitely want to, you'd quickly be closing down. Because if you could ship it over state lines, there's just lower cost areas to grow it in and source it from in the country.
Okay. So you just briefly mentioned shipping over state lines. Do you buy everything in Massachusetts or can be bought across the country? How does that work?
Yeah, no. So cannabis is federally legal. So the second it moves over a state line, that's a federal act. So you're violating federal law.
Yep.
So you have to buy everything from a, you know, cultivator manufacturer here in Massachusetts.
Okay. Okay. So everything that you do, everything you buy is all Massachusetts grown or produced.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. I was unsure of that because I, you know, again, you mentioned, you know, growing out in the western part of the country and you think of where dispensaries like really were, or the cultivators were in, you know, California, Colorado, that area where it was, I think, legal a lot sooner than it was here. Correct.
Yep. Yeah.
You mentioned a little bit about regulatory law or what happens in Massachusetts. Do you get inspectors come in and just unannounced like we do with healthcare, where they show up and say, let's see all the licenses for all your providers. Let's look at all your HR, you know, your HR folder and see if all your stuff is there to make sure you're abiding by the state regulation. Does that happen to you as well?
Yeah. So in Massachusetts, we're regulated by the Cannabis Control Commission or the CCC.
Mm-hmm.
So they will do surprise inspections of, you know, sort of all the licensees, you know, in the retail world. They're coming in, they're checking security, they're checking inventory, right? Ultimately, their biggest thing on a retailer is, can you account for everything that you brought in wholesale and haven't sold to an end customer? So there's a state-run data tracking system called Metric, sort of industry-wide. So, you know, your Metric reports have to tie out to what's physically in your inventory. And then, you know, they do, will check HR things. So your employee files, right? All employees have to have a background check and get an agent card from the state. So they are checking those things. But the biggest is probably inventory and security.
Mm-hmm. Now, the products that you guys, you know, have for retail in your stores, is it strictly cannabis? Do you have gummies? Do you have, I think, drinks, lotions, all that type of stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. So cannabis can be consumed in numerous form factors. So, you know, we have flower, which, you know, obviously you sell as flower and people can grind and make their own pre-rolls. There's pre-rolls, there's concentrates, vaporizers, edibles from gummies, you know, chocolates, you know, people have infused everything from ketchup to honey to, at one point we had ramen salt. We have infused ice cubes.
Any gummy bears?
There's gummies. Lots of gummies, yeah. No gummy bears. Massachusetts prevents any, you know, edible to take the form of an animal.
For children, right? Yeah. Is that the regulation? Yeah.
Yep. So generally, they're just squares or like a hexagon or something.
Yeah.
Topicals, tinctures, lots of drinks. Drinks have become a bigger form factor to consume in. Mm-hmm. Inhalers. So there's and that list will continue to grow as the industry evolves.
What would you say your biggest, if you had to put your finger on it, I'm sure it's pretty easy for you to tell, but what's the biggest seller? What do you see it shifting from? I mean, usually you would think of everybody would go to the flower, right? But if they're not, what's the biggest seller that's out there for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, industry-wide, it's definitely flour is still the dominant, right? I would tell you flour between just buying the bud itself or in pre-rolls is still probably 50 to 60% of the overall market. Mm-hmm. Our stores are a little different. We tend to sell a lot of vaporizers and gummies.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, the four big categories are flour, pre-rolls, vapes, and gummies.
Okay.
I mean, that dominates 80 to 90% of your sales.
Okay.
And sort of everything else fills in the balance.
Now, can you still get the same benefit of all the others instead of the flower? So if you took anything off the shelf and put it in front of someone, say 10 items, and said, every day, try one of each, would it still have the same benefit or is it different concentrations? And the only reason I ask that is that somebody that doesn't want to smoke or vaporize, like, and they want the same benefit for medical use, is it the same concentration?
You can get them in this sort of same, if I call it dosing, right? Like the percentage of total cannabinoids that you're taking in. Yes. Mm-hmm. It is different, right? So if you smoke or vaporize, you're taking it in through your lungs, which is a very effective and almost immediate way to consume, right? So you'll feel it very quickly.
Right. So and it just transforms across your bloodstream through your airway. Right. Yeah.
With edibles, on the other hand, though, right, you have to process that through your liver, right, to get it into your bloodstream. So it is a much longer onset. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of nano emulsifications that are going on in terms of like just food development technology that the industry is leveraging to try to build sort of fast acting. So you'll see groups say, you know, it's 5, 10 minutes, 15-minute onset. You know, but what I always tell people with edibles are, everybody's body processes differently, mm-hmm. right? So start small, start with a very low dose, take it and wait at least 2 hours to see what happens, because it can be as that slow as 2-3 hours before it actually hits you. You know, I think the big mistake is if you get a bag of gummies and you pop one and you're like 10 minutes later, like that did nothing and you just keep popping these things.
Like Wolf of Wall Street when they were eating the lemons.
That's right. Yeah. You know, and then all of a sudden it hits you, right? So it's definitely, you know, the onset time is different based on how you consume. And then, listen, there are definitely people who will say, edibles just don't affect me. I have to either smoke or vaporize it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, there are other people who are like, no, I mean, edibles really can kick me in the butt and it definitely works fast and it's great. So, mm-hmm. you know, everyone does process this differently. So I think that's the biggest thing, right? Is the onset, and it's, you know, flowers definitely think of it as it's going to be quick when you smoke it. It will sort of fade off sooner as opposed to edibles take longer to hit you, but will last longer.
Mm-hmm. Now you mentioned at the beginning, I think you said you do consultations. Is that, and can you just elaborate on that a little bit and what that means if someone comes into your location?
Yeah. So you literally can go on our website and book a consultation, in which case you'll meet with one of our, you know, more trained sales reps, and we'll just sit with you. We've got sort of a little consultation area. We can sit on the couches together and they can talk you through the product and, you know, all the different form factors. They can talk you through kind of like, generally, what we want to understand is, why are you here? What are you mm-hmm. trying to achieve? Right, cannabis, you know, it's a funny product in the sense that, you know, it can help with appetite suppressant, or it can actually help make you hungry. Right,
right.
It can
eat give a bunch you the of Cheetos.
Yeah. So it is, you know, there's definitely different outcomes. There's, you know, it can make you sleepy, or it can make you really give you a lot of energy. And you know, there's products that people will be like, you should take this before you go to the gym, mm-hmm. right? So it is definitely, you know, something that's very varied in terms of its effects. So we always want to understand, like, why are you here? You know, what is it that you're trying to achieve? So someone who says, listen, and by far, probably the biggest thing people ask for is sleep help. Where they'll come in and say, I don't sleep well. You know, everyone keeps telling me I got to try this. So here I am. Right. And so we talk through them about all the different sleep choices we have and how they work. You know, we definitely talk about titration, which is this idea of start small, you know, work up, find kind of that right amount for you. And so it's a lot of ad education, right? And then we'll, if, you know, we will get parents, you want to talk about safe storage. How do you safely store these things? Keep them out of the way from children, right? We have things that we'll sell, that accessories that like essentially locking boxes or bags, if you want to keep it out of the way. So there's, you know, we want to be able to answer all the questions, right? Because I think people come in and, you know, they're very confused. It's not like what they remember from growing up. It's, you know, the dusty bag of weed that you may have had with your buddies, or the brownie that you may have had at a party.
Right.
You know, cannabis has really evolved. It has gotten a lot more potent than from years ago. And so, you know, I think it's important that people get educated because we want them to have a good experience, you know, versus,
Which is good. Now, does every organization do that, or this is something you guys felt was good for your company and for your brand?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was good for our brand and our company, right? You know, I remember early days, a lot of people making the analogy of, oh, this is like prohibition ending, which I totally get the comparison. I guess for me, you know, I thought the big difference was like, yeah, when prohibition ended, I think everyone knew how alcohol hit them. Right. Mm-hmm. Everyone sort of knows what it means to drink a beer or have a glass of whiskey. Right. It's not true for cannabis. Cannabis hits people very differently. And it's a very different product. So, you know, for us, what I like to tell people, you know, hey, we're trying to sell the experience of cannabis. Right. And so if that experience that you're looking for is help with sleep, or no, I'm going to the concert at Fenway and I'm here to have fun. Versus, hey, I'm having, you know, we definitely get cancer patients who are having a lot of nausea and they have no appetite. So, you know, these are very different things we're going to want to recommend to you, right? So, you know, as opposed to alcohol, sort of has one effect. And I think people were, you know, they knew what it was like after prohibition to be like, yeah, I'm going to go buy some alcohol now. So I thought it was very important to our brand. Under the medical program, so if you get a medical card, medical dispensaries have to offer consultations, but adult use dispensaries do not. So most don't, because, you know, at the end of the day, you are tying up an employee for 15 to 45 minutes an hour. So most groups don't do it. Most groups are more, you know, come in, place your order. Yeah, we'll answer questions while you're at the counter, but, you know, it's just a quick interaction with you at the counter.
Yeah. I mean, it's good that you do that, because it sounds like you want to preserve the brand and make it different from what else is out there. It's kind of like we talk about in the physical therapy or sports medicine world, you know, how do we become different from everybody else? And I think it's the interaction, it's the conversation, it's getting to know, I guess, your client, right? And they are a client of yours, or hopefully a future client of yours. And if you provide that type of service for them, they're the ones that are going to come back and still support you as an organization, right?
That's right. That's the hope.
Yeah, which is good. Can you describe CBD and how's that different? Like, what is that a byproduct of the flower? How is that different from just like marijuana, or is it the same thing?
Yeah. So if you think of cannabis as a plant, right? It's the flower that everyone is really seeking. So actually, you know, when you see the stereotypical marijuana leaf, that is, candidly, that's garbage, right?
Yeah.
People trim that off and that goes in the garbage can.
Yeah.
So it's the bud, right? And within that flower, you know, there are, you know, probably over 200 different organic chemical compounds, which are called cannabinoids. Of those, the most famous or most, you know, known is THC and CBD, right? THC is the one that everyone associates with the idea of getting high. CBD or cannabidiol is just another one of these cannabinoids, right? And while there's, you know, obviously medical research has been limited, you know, there's been studies that show that it can alleviate pain, anxiety, you know, it's really an anti-inflammatory, can improve mood, reduce headaches. A lot of that is anecdotal, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's a Schedule One narcotic, there isn't a lot of research on it, at least in the U.S. That being said, there is an FDA-approved drug from GW Pharma that is specifically for it's an anti-seizure medicine.
Okay.
It is 100% plant-based CBD medicine. So, you know, the tide's turning there, right, where even the FDA has to acknowledge that there's medical benefit here. And so it will be good over time to see more true medical research and studies done to know what the plant can do, what are really the benefits of CBD, THC, and a lot of the other cannabinoids.
Okay.
CBN is one for appetite suppressant, right? Could that be an alternative to a GLP-1 drug? Those kind of things.
Yeah, because you don't hear a lot about the other stuff. And I being as, you know, green as you can be on this, I think understanding the difference between, like you said, THC and CBD, because people ask us about CBD.
Yeah.
And I usually refer them back to their primary care. I said, well, you should go talk to your primary care because I don't know enough about it. I'm not going to tell you to go buy it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's good to be able to have that differentiation. But, you know, that being said, you mentioned like the federal rate, you know, being a narcotic and a Schedule One narcotic, I think, right? So you look at the federal law and regulation. Do you see that the federal government is ever going to recognize this in the industry or start to recognize it more and accept it in as a beneficial way to be able to treat, like we had just mentioned, like a lot of these diseases and disorders? Because it sounds like you can do it in somewhat of a natural way, right? And there's a lot of ways to be able to consume it. And the other, I guess, part two to that question is, I mean, there's a lot of money to be made in the federal government by this. I mean, you think about it, it's taxable, right? If they did accept it. So they could definitely help with a lot of the financial changes that you and I have actually talked about, the financial stuff too on the side. But yeah, so question one is, do you think the federal government is going to recognize at some point, or is it in process? And two, what do you think about the federally, you know, the federal benefit or the financial benefit for the federal government?
Yeah. So to the first part, right now the industry is all waiting for what's called rescheduling. So mm-hmm. President Biden did direct the Secretary of Health and Human Services to go look at the scheduling of cannabis. They have come back and recommended that it get rescheduled to Schedule 3.
Okay.
And now it's sort of in the DEA's hands on to actually implementing that, or, you know, candidly, they could reject it. It would be the first time DEA was rejected a recommendation from Health and Human Services. But, you know, everyone in the industry is sort of waiting. And for us, the industry-wide, outside of that, it would open up the doors to, I think, more true research. What everyone's really hopeful for with it is it actually eliminates this tax called, there's a 280E tax code, which essentially says if you are Schedule 1 or 2 narcotic, you can't deduct anything from your business operations other than your cost of goods sold.
Mm-hmm.
So the practical thing for us, I can't deduct rent. I can't deduct payroll. The only thing that's deductible to us is actually the cost we pay to a cultivator for the cannabis product itself.
Mm-hmm.
So the industry is waiting for this because it would be a huge financial boom to all of us in terms of our day-to-day business operations,
mm-hmm.
Free up a lot of cash flow for reinvestments, things like that. You know, in terms of the federal government and where they come out on tax. So a lot of people say, oh, you know, the feds would never do this because they'll lose tax revenue.
Yeah.
You know, to me, I sort of look at it as, I don't know how big of a tax input this really is to the overall budget of the federal government. But that being said, right, I mean, if the federal government were to do some type of reform, realistically, it follows down the path of alcohol and there'd just be an excise tax on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it would just be at a much larger scale because, you know, once there is federal reform, right, you'll see, I think, a lot more businesses enter it. I think the total revenues for the industry will scale up very quickly from there.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll be taxing a larger base. So there's a long way to go and everyone's trying to read the tea leaves. You know, what if Trump wins? What's he going to do? They're sort of waiting for him to comment. Florida right now is going through an adult use ballot question.
Yeah.
The governor of Florida has opposed it. Trump has said he'll comment on it shortly. Vice President Harris has said she is supportive of legalizing cannabis. Vice President nominee Waltz, you know, he's actually been a big champion within the state of Minnesota to legalize. So, mm-hmm. Everyone's trying to read the tea leaves here. Because, you know, it is an interesting industry where you're always walking this line of, okay, I got to be state legal, but I've got this overhang of it's federally illegal on us.
Yeah. And then, so how does that affect you if, you know, revenue based? So think of, how do you guys deal with your, profit? Like, how does that work? How do you deposit? Like, can you deposit money in the bank? Like, how does that work? Like, if it's federally illegal, how does that work?
Yeah. I mean, so for us in Massachusetts, we've been fortunate because there have been banks from the beginning of the medical days that would bank the industry.
Okay.
For the most part, they were either state chartered or they were a credit union. Yeah. And not that these aren't FDIC insured. They are, right? The FDIC put more reporting requirements on them, but they were willing to do it. Right. They were not fearful of losing their bank charter license.
Mm-hmm.
So we in Massachusetts, we've been very fortunate. I think everyone's at least had a checking account. There may have been ridiculous fees on it, but at least, the money's going into a bank. It's not sitting in, you're safe in the store.
Under your mattress.
Yeah. We never had those days. Other states, we had that, right? I mean, if you look at Colorado, Nevada, they were, for the most part, banks wouldn't touch them.
Yeah.
So these were cash run businesses. And, I know people in those states and they spent a lot of time trying to manage that. And, all their payroll was done through taxes. They would do withholdings and then, have to pay their taxes in cash.
Yeah.
So
that's crazy to think that it's like the Wild West. Like, think about that. You have all that money floating around and what's your security detail look like? I'm sure it's pretty crazy if you have that much money floating around.
Yeah, you know. I met someone, he joked with me once, he had a safe house. And I was like, what's that? He goes, you go to the worst part of town and you buy a house. And I was like, why the worst part? Because you have to be able to windows over the plywood over the windows. So on the other side, there'd be steel plates. He'd have guys in there 24/7 with guns. Mm. And it was just a house where he kept his cash. But you had to be able to sort of like bulletproof it a little bit and being able to put plywood on the outside, you wouldn't want it, need to be in a really bad part of town so that didn't like make anyone think twice.
Right. That's interesting.
That's
pretty crazy.
Yeah. So there were definitely some Wild West days. But like I said, no one in Massachusetts had to go through that.
We were
very fortunate.
Well, it probably also, tells the story of the amount of locations there are. I think I was commenting to you, I went out to Western Mass and it seemed like there was every other billboard was a cannabis billboard. And and is it a looser regulation in different parts of the state, or is it the same, or just geographically where places have popped up?
Yeah, I mean, so again, it's up to the local communities, right? So so technically, the way question four, the original ballot question, worked was if your community voted yes for it, you then had to issue 20% of the number of off-premise liquor licenses for dispensary licenses, right?
Really?
So if you had 4 liquor licenses in your town and your town voted yes for it, you had to give out 1 dispensary license.
Okay.
Right. Right. If you had 5 liquor licenses, I'd say you'd have to give at least 1. And then if you were a no town, then you could ban it.
Okay.
So there are a lot of, Weston, Wellesley, for example, are both banned towns.
Yeah.
So they're, they do not have to permit a dispensary here.
Okay. Doesn't mean it's out of the question, though, right? They could still
They could still do it. But it's up to them. But they don't have to do it.
Okay.
Right. So, and in Western Mass, there was just a lot more communities that were open to the idea of dispensaries. So they embraced the concept, and they, were happy to issue a bunch of licenses. Advertising is very tricky. So when you advertise here in Massachusetts, you have to know that 85% of the viewership is 21 plus.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure how that works with billboards, to be candid, right? To me, that implies 85% of the people driving their car are 21 plus, which I don't think is statistically possible. But the billboard companies have data that will attest to that, and the Cannabis Control Commission has accepted that.
Okay.
So therefore, billboards work. The Cannabis Control Commission would tell you, you could probably be in print media, right? Mm-hmm. So physical newspapers, physical magazines, but realistically, you couldn't be on their online version.
Yeah.
They've sort of accepted that 21-year-olds don't read the paper anymore. Mm-hmm. If they read it, they read a digital version of it.
Right.
So advertising is very tricky in this space. Mm-hmm. And billboards is an acceptable use. And so I think if a billboard company is willing to take you, I think people have seized upon it.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I was trying to figure that out too when I was driving out there. I'm like, there's a lot of billboards out here that are advertising, which was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
So what do you think the future of the industry looks like? We just briefly touched like the federal piece, but do you think it's something that's going to, you know, continue to grow, or do you feel like there's going to be like a ceiling and that's about it?
No, I mean, I think, you know, take whatever analogy of the toothpaste is out of the tube or the genie's out of the lamp. You know, I don't think there's turning back now, right?
Okay.
It's we have adult use in, I think count is 23, 24 states now. There's some medical program in over 40 states. I think it's 70% of the U.S. population lives in a legalized state.
Okay.
So I think there's just too much adoption. There are too many jobs, too much local tax revenue to ever sort of turn the dial back. So I think federal reform does need to happen at some point. That said, one thing I've learned is the federal government is not in the business of making something legal without having all of the regulatory framework around it. And I think that's going to be the really challenging point for cannabis, is trying to figure out how do you legalize this and give all of the regulatory oversight that this industry needs from a federal level without disrupting what's already been done in so many different states. Mm-hmm. Right? And candidly, our regulations in Massachusetts are very different than Connecticut, Maine, you know, New York, New Jersey, Oklahoma, California, right? All these other states have very different regulatory systems, you know, who's responsible for what limits there are. That I think it's going to be really challenging to sort of bring it all in line.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the most realistic outcome would be a pathway that sort of takes it the same way as alcohol. Meaning, so if you look at the 21st Amendment, 21st Amendment actually does not make alcohol legal in the US. It just makes it no longer illegal.
Okay.
And what they said was, okay, all you states, you go figure out what you want to do. The federal government will set sort of a standard labeling requirement. Right. So alcohol by proof is a federal thing, and kind of what you can put on the bottle is a federal requirement, but really state by state laws that dictate alcohol. And why in Massachusetts, for example, we had blue laws into the 80s where, you know, you couldn't buy alcohol on a Sunday. You know, yep. We don't have happy hours. There's no public consumption, versus it's very different in other states. You know, Mississippi was the last state to legalize, which was in 1966,
mm-hmm.
right? So 33 years after 21st Amendment ended was, you know, before all 50 states, you could actually buy alcohol legally. I think that's arguably the best framework because, you know, we have all these different regulations across different states. And I think there will be some states that will want to keep it as a no for a much longer period, and following kind of the alcohol framework sort of gives you that outcome.
Yeah.
So I am hopeful that the federal government kind of will see that reform. There's a lot of lobby around that, obviously, because, you know, from larger players, specifically the alcohol industry, that would want to see that regulation rolled out. And basically a lot of the control would fall into kind of alcohol regulators, and they would want to implement that three-tier system of producer, distributor, retailer, where they could step into the industry very naturally, you know, because you're definitely seeing alcohol consumption come down. And I think a lot of that is a turn into cannabis. So, mm-hmm. you know, from their business perspective, it makes all the sense. And, you know, I think that's probably the most likely path forward if I were to bet. You know, that said, I think of the Trump administration, if Trump wins and second administration of his, I don't know that anything really happens under him. You know, obviously, I think under Harris, I think there's more of an opportunity. But I think it's a question of when, not if.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, you can't just take one state's regulatory, you know, statute or the regulatory, I guess, framework, and then just use that across a blanket United States, right? Because everybody set this up.
Right.
It would have been the better way to do it would have been the federal government said, okay, this is the framework everybody has to work from.
Right.
And then everybody would have had the same framework. And then you could have some offshoots of the framework, but it's kind of tough to go back from that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to your point, like California passed medical back in like 2009 or something. I mean, so they've been doing, you know, decades, right? So, it, you know, it's, I think it, at this point that ship sailed.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, it's, it would be a long process to try to bring everyone in line with each other. And because it's, it is very different, right? You know, I would tell you right now, Oklahoma is probably the loosest state. Mm-hmm. And you know, cannabis availability is abundant and they have way oversupplied it. You know, where Massachusetts, we have the strictest regulations in terms of what we can grow and, you know, mm-hmm. the quality it's got to pass and, from lab testing. So, you know, where, you know, which one of us has the right answer, right? I mean, consumers can argue on both sides of it. People in the industry can argue on both sides of it. So finding that common ground, I think, would be really difficult and challenging. And so I think we're going to end up in a situation where the federal government's going to lay over some base standards that applies to everybody, but then it's a lot of it's going to be state by state.
Yeah. Well, interesting. We'll time will tell, right? And I guess it depends on what administration and even future administrations right after that, because it's going to take some time, it sounds like.
Yeah, definitely.
Like everything we know that hits the hill takes a long time.
Oh, yeah. No, nothing can be fast from that perspective.
Never. Government works very slow.
Yep.
Well, Victor, thanks again for coming on today. I do appreciate your time. Before we part ways, what's a maybe a little fun fact about Victor that people would find either intriguing or you know interesting about yourself?
Fun fact. Yeah, I don't know that I have a good one. You know, dad of two, just trying to grind through 13 and 11-year-old and get them through schooling. I love golf. That's my big passion.
Yeah.
And maybe my wife would say it's the fact that I do live 4 miles from my childhood home and really haven't gotten very far from that perspective. So
well, that's good. I mean, it's at least, you know, like you said earlier, it's I think probably the friendship piece is an interesting one, too. A lot of us kept our few friends, but it seems like you have an abundance of your high school buddies that you still keep in touch with, which is actually pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, Victor, thanks again. I wish you guys luck with the business and, you know, hopefully many more years of success. And again, thanks. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we're committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportscience.com. This is your host, Andrew Rizza. If you enjoyed today's episode, give us a like, comment, and share it on social media. Access all of our episodes on platforms such as Apple, Spotify, or your preferred podcast app. Stay updated by following us on Instagram at Behind Sports Med Podcast, on X at AJR Sports Sci, or visiting our website at ajrsportscience.podbean.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at AJR Sports Science for upcoming content. Thank you for tuning in and stay tuned for our next episode.